Igor talks on experiencing in unity consciousness.
You will see that this person has profound level of realization, profound level of understanding, and we're just going to go through them just to bounce off and hopefully perhaps reconcile and respond to certain maybe, don't want to call them dilemmas, but certain questions that may still linger there. Because no matter how great is our understanding, no matter how great is our experience, sometimes that experience needs to be put through the test of, let's say, by reflecting it to someone, we have that reflection back, and that allows a greater degree of integration. So the question itself comes from the main theme of the last webinar, which is, as many of you remember, was addressing the differences in degrees of self-realization, or differences between the states of what we understand by awakening, self-realization and enlightenment. The video is still out there for those of you who have not had the chance to see it yet. It is entitled The Seer, The Seeing and The Seen. The three aspects of consciousness that is required for any experience to take place. Because it's pretty obvious, you know? There's always the one who sees, there's always object, and there is this process, there is this relationship between the seer and the seen. So the question is rather long. So I will read it to you slowly, and we'll go over it, and there will be two more questions that kind of, actually three more questions that open up that theme even further. Here is the question. My experience unfolded with the realization of the self as distinct from the objective world. There was the self, and then there was everything else, clearly dualistic. As my experience developed from there, I began to notice a fascination with the objects of perception. Somehow they began to appear more luminescent, radiant, though in the form of clear or invisible light. Then I began to notice that there was something underneath the objects, beginning to see the colorless sap. The objects became increasingly transparent, as though I could see through the colorless sap. During this time, any sense of being a subject had also become transparent to the colorless sap, and everything in the perception simply become dominated by colorless sap, which I recognize was the true underlying nature of everything, including myself. So, as my experience unfolded, I found that the subject-object relationship simply became transparent, invisible in a sense, to the realization of everything as the self. You seem to describe the subject-object relationship as no longer existing. Now, my question. Would you say that the subject-object relationship actually does still exist and operates in its own realm? The functioning of the senses, brain interpreting the input from the senses, etc., responsible for perception. But this subject-object functioning is merely invisible, inverted commas, with no identification of the self within it? Or would you say that the subject-object relationship simply does not exist? Very beautiful experience. This is first response. This is a beautiful experience which is technically known in the movement where this person obviously has been trained in is known as unity consciousness. This is experience of unity consciousness in its most acute and its most simple And the way it is presented, it's very much in line, or let's say in tune, with the way Maharishi Mahesh Yogi himself spoke of that process. Because Maharishi often had that allegory or metaphor when he spoke of this process, emphasizing on that every, let's say, living plant has a sap within. And there's this famous talk about the rose which is, let's say, a red rose. But when we start going deeper and deeper into the structure of that rose, then what we find is that that redness of the rose, although it's there on the obvious surface level, it's becoming less and less pronounced, less and less emphasized, until it becomes like, let's say, pale rose, you know, until it's like really, really diluted, until we arrive to the colorless sap of the rose. It's become completely transparent. Anyone who has been associated with TM movement, I'm sure, have heard that talk of Maharishi on the colorless sap with the example of the rose, and it's a beautiful one. So yes, this is, you know, the way you've described your experience is very much, very much in tune with what I was trying to structurally, I emphasize structurally, to convey in that first webinar. Because up until that experience becomes reality, almost reality, it's very hard to imagine. I would say it's even impossible to imagine how can object and subject collapse, or how can object and subject disappear, become transparent, because that's not the prevalent experience of someone else. And in order to convey the stages in the process of what we know as awakening and gradual realization of the self to the full embodiment, and, you know, known as enlightenment, the purpose of that talk was to emphasize that this is not a switch of a button event. So that there is this bias in the spiritual community today where people speak of the shift in awareness as the only needed ingredient for enlightenment to occur. We know that not to be true. However, to your question, would I consider, would I say that subject object relationship simply does not exist? Again, when we speak of existence, we have to remember that what exists on one plane of reality may not exist on another plane of reality. Does not mean that what does not exist on respective plane of reality is the only truth. You see, this is a very interesting way of understanding this whole phenomenon of Maya. Some schools, like let's say Advaita, dismisses, or at least the way Advaita has been understood so far, dismisses the validity or the reality of this manifested world on the account that it's ever-changing reality. This reality is a complete and constant change. Those who know the philosophy of Samkhya know that it is based in the mutability of nature, a constant change between different energies, known as Rajas, Tamas, and Sattva, and they rotate like a clock. And that rotation gives the appearance of the world as being, let's say, solid, as being embedded with this or that quality. Is it real or is it unreal? Depends on the level where experience itself takes place. If I were to speak from the platform that I myself gravitate towards or have greater affinity with, the tantric non-dualist Shaiva philosophy of Kashmir Valley, Kashmir Shaivism as it is known, then this whole relationship in fact is seen as the creative tension between the pure awareness as Shiva and the field of potentiality as Shakti. And between these two, which is always one, there is tension, there's creative tension. It is Shiva that is contracting to his self in order for the universe to exist as Shakti. And Shakti, basically, when Shakti awakens, it brings the world to end so that the Shiva can experience its expansion. That creative tension of constant expansion and constant contraction is what makes this phenomenal world a place where all this is taking place. And immediately to add to that, with the human body as that beautiful instrument that could be tuned in, literally, like you tune in the guitar, like you tune in the piano, or like you tune in the violin or sitar, that beautiful instrument can resonate with the overall harmony that is perhaps the leitmotif of this creation, of the expansion of Shiva as Shakti. Sorry, the contraction of Shiva and expansion of Shakti, because it's always at one at the expense of the other. This is very, very important. It's always at the expense, always, because that's the nature of the sacrifice. Pure awareness is sacrificing itself, contracting, in order for this multiplicity and diversity to take place. And then this diversity collapses to itself in order for the awareness to come forth and being experienced as the primal force, as Shiva. So the human being is right in the epicenter of that amazing dance of Shiva Shakti, that amazing tension. In fact, the word Tantra, properly understood, is not what is written in many, many books today, and that does not mean to cast shadows on the, you know, promulgators and propagators of Tantra today in the West largely, but just to give that additional understanding, the true meaning of the word Tantra, it's tuning in something that is being, with the help of that, something is being tuned in. Understand it the way it resonates with you. So just as we tune in all the different strings of this spiritual anatomy, you know, all these different strings, all these different modalities, all these different colors of the rainbow, which resonate at a particular pitch, each psychic center has its own sound. And all together, they create this orchestrated music that we know of this wonderful existence. This is why Tantra belongs to the all-embracing aspect of Indian spirituality. It's not as classically understood Advaita, when you abstract yourself, when you almost at the expense of nihilating the world out there, because the world is being seen as Maya or illusion. And Maya, in this case, is a definition, not as it seems. It's not illusion as it is often translated, but actually the true meaning of Maya, not what it seems. So does subject-object relationship exist? As you can see, that there is no such thing that to give it a one definitive answer. It does and it does not. And it's in perfect alignment with what I just shared in terms of Shiva-Shakti relationship, the relationship between pure awareness and pure potentiality. Pure potentiality of the expression of that pure awareness through the field which is the universe as we know it. So that subject-object relationship exists on some plane and it does not exist on another. When Shiva takes over through the awakened Shakti, when pure awareness becomes predominant factor, obviously subject-object relationship makes no sense. Where is the subject-object? It's all one Shiva, it's all one awareness. How can there be any relationship of the sort? And yet, when awareness is concealed to itself in the domain of Shakti, subject and object relationship is what gives this world amazing play and richness of experience. So the answer is yes and no, and reconciled in that expansion and contraction. It always expands and always contracts. Not just seeing it in a linear sense of time, but it always expands and always contracts. And yet there is a common moment when, let's say, on individual level, there is this definitive awakening. And that's what we call the awakening on this very level. And then the contraction is reached the moment when it cannot contract any further and it expands. Likewise, on the level of the universe, you know, like in Indian tradition, it's like Shiva closes eyes, Shiva opens eyes. You know, the eyes are shut, you know. Shiva, all there is Shiva. All there is pure awareness. Soon as the Shiva opens the eyes, there is the universe. There is existence. And it takes us to the second question. I found your video where you talked about Rishi Devata Chandas, which is in this case the seer, the seeing, and the object. Rishi is the seer, Devata is the seeing, the process, and Chandas is an object, something that has been seen, perceived. To be quite interesting, I experienced the merging of Rishi and Chandas so far as I understand what you were saying. It seems that there is only seeing. Would you say Chandas, the object, is what physics might describe as an interference pattern, which is the object, a vibration of the quantum field? I'm not very conversant in physics, so I may have the term wrong. What struck me when I had you on your video was a deep intuition which I cannot articulate about Chandas, object. Well, I've never said that I'm conversant in physics either, so I only give this like little sentence or two just to give a Western mind which is more, let's say, acquainted with that kind of logical understanding where the language of the mathematics ingrained speaks on yet another level. You know, one could speak completely from a different perspective on this subject. However, what you just asked in itself is the reply to that question, and I'm sure you see that question contains answer in itself. That indeed it's the greatest mystery, that interference pattern of that only seeing that is real. And some teachers are unapologetic about it. Some teachers, they say that there is only experiencing. There is only Devata, the quality of experiencing. There is only seeing, smelling, experiencing through the touch, hearing, all the gamut of sensory perceptions with which the human body is equipped to navigate itself through the field of experience itself. So if you cannot articulate your question about Chandas, That in itself, an interesting thing, don't you think? That in itself says a lot about the object. Something which we cannot put our finger on. Like some teachers say, like, you know, like in a landscape, we see this on a screen of our retina, you know, because that's the way the human eye sees, perceives. You see something out there, which then gets through the process of being turned upside down and then somewhere on the cortex is being turned again. So it's like it goes through that flippant process only to be perceived on the screen, which is what? Which is the screen of awareness, in this case, individual mind. And yet, when we will try to put our finger at a particular spot of the landscape, we cannot do that. That is an example of how objectivity of this world is the greatest mystery. Something that is almost refuses to be identified as what it appears like. And this is why it is called Maya. It's not what it seems. Just like with, you know, on a larger scale, you see the sun set behind the horizon, but what you see is a phenomena of the light of the sun that travels to the earth in however many minutes it takes, 7 or 8, I don't remember. So what you see in that given moment in time does not exist already. And which takes us to the third question. More recently, I have been finding that I am experiencing what seems to be a structural correlation between objects of perception and my physical body. It seems as though the objects perceived are felt as being my body. Also, not as separate objects existing out in space away from my body, but as though inside my body, even though I have no sense of inside and outside. I find it difficult to really describe. While I have not read Tony Nader's book about the correlation of astrology or the Vedas with the human body, I imagine what I'm experiencing may be related in some way. Is any of this similar to your experience? Any comments would be appreciated. What you said in the first half of this question, what you've described in the first half, is experiencing the what is known as the outer world as one's own body is the bingo moment. That is the glimpse, a definitive, distinctive glimpse of unity consciousness. This is the actual experience of non-dual experience in action. Because this whole phenomena of experiencing ourself as separate from the what is being experienced is in fact the very seed of illusion. That is the Maya. There is no Maya out there. The Maya is actually through this very limited and concealed instrumentality of the senses, the way they function, the way they provide us with the information. And yet, when the being experiences these glimpses of unity consciousness, many of them report is that whenever the sense object is uniting with the object of experience, there is this sensation of complete unity, that there is no separation. So it's as it were, whatever you put your hand on, if you perceive, like let's say through the sense of touch, it is as if you're feeling your own self. It's this familiarity. It's this intimacy of experience. Whatever your eye falls on, it's the same. Whatever you hear, it's the same. It is an amazing experience when you hear someone saying, singing, screaming, crying, yelling at you. You experience it as yourself. It could be actually very, very peculiar way. You know, someone literally expresses the, let's say, disconcern. Or, you know, someone in a state of stress is yelling at you. Instead, you're experiencing your own self. So your reaction is nowhere retaliative. How can you retaliate towards yourself? You cannot. As for the second part of the question, with the example of the Tony Nader, which is basically the successor of Maharishi, known today as Adhiraj Raja Ram, and his groundbreaking book, the first one, is The Human Physiology and the Veda, that was published back in the 90s, and the more recent book, Ramayana, The Physiology, The Human Physiology and Ramayana. I don't want to go into it because it's a very, very big theme in itself, but I don't sense that is what the Tony Nader's discoveries are. Tony Nader's discoveries are very specific, and they're discoveries only in terms of discoveries for the modern age within a given culture. They're not discoveries as such, they are rediscoveries or confirmations of what was always known. Anyone who has experienced the complete, let's say, embodiment of pure awareness as the self within this human physiology, in time finds that all that exists in the universe, and above all, let's say, in our immediate universe, like, let's say, the planets, you know, these divine beings in our solar system, are structured through our physiology, structured through our cortexes. How can that be otherwise? And, you know, it's very simple. Before, there was this cosmic dust rotating at a very high speed around this newly born sun when it all took place at the early stages, let's say, of that space-time frame, space-time reality. There were no planets as yet, you know, there was nothing. There was just this, a cloud of dust rotating around the sun. And yet the gravitational forces and all this, you know, like, I'm sure the cosmology, those who are versed in cosmology will find it very easy to explain, formed into what we know as Venus, as Jupiter, as Saturn, and as our beautiful planet Earth. So everything that exists within that solar system and on our planet Earth would have that recorded, coded within, on the DNA level and on the actual structural physiology. And this is what Tony Nader's books are really about. Not to mention now about the Vedic science. As I said, it's a very big subject in itself. And final question from that person, from the self, because I feel I speak to someone who I'm almost like reading the questions that I could address myself at some point of my own spiritual practice. And the fourth question is, I believe you mentioned on one of your videos about the various samadhis, but did not classify transcendental consciousness as though or as thought in TM as a form of samadhi. I thought that pure transcendental consciousness was a form of samadhi. Did I misunderstand you? Or do I have a different understanding of what Maharishi meant by the term transcendental consciousness? I think I did speak about it in that video, but I will make it clear again, is that the difference between a state of consciousness, let's say in this case, transcendental state of consciousness, right? Or Turiya, as it is known in Sanskrit, and samadhi, is that samadhi has beginning and it has end. transcendental consciousness, or any state of consciousness in that matter, when we talk about the higher states of consciousness, has no beginning and end. It is the state of consciousness. It may become, let's say, cosmic God unity consciousness, but it's the same strata. It's a substratum on which all other states of consciousness take place. Samadhi, in this case, when we speak of both Nirvikalpa and Savikalpa Samadhi, or Prajnata and Asamprajnata, as they are known in the yoga philosophy, these are distinctive states that are experienced for a length of time. You cannot be in Samadhi permanently. You have to come out of Samadhi to function. And that's the difference. So, yes, when you experience transcendental consciousness in meditation, when the meditator experiences transcendental consciousness during his meditative practice, he taps into Samadhi, whatever Samadhi or whatever form of Samadhi that is, with awareness. I should have said earlier that Savikalpa, which literally means Samadhi with the Kalpa, Kalpa in this case stands for the thought, vibration of mind, thought, or Nirvikalpa, which obviously means without a thought, without any awareness. There is awareness, but it's a different form of awareness. Awareness not of the mental modifications. So, in meditation, meditator taps in or enters Samadhi state, and then he or she comes out into the field of action to act. So indeed, that is what Maharishi meant, that transcendental consciousness is a form of Samadhi, is a Samadhi. But it is more than just a temporal state of Samadhi, because once the meditator is established on the level of transcendental consciousness, when the gunas no longer overshadow that transcendental state, he or she functions in the world regardless of what kind of activity is being chosen. That is the main difference. In Samadhi, classically speaking, you can be only for 21 days. This is what yogic texts say. After 21 days, if the meditator, yogi, what have you, tantric, you know, Buddha, if you are in that Samadhi state for 21 days, then consciousness has to either leave the body through its apertures, or it has to regain the level of consciousness where it can take possession of the faculties again. Otherwise, something, perhaps, on a chemical level, which can no longer support that process. This is why, you know, in yogic tradition, when someone is in Samadhi, they even feed them gently with a bit of like a spoonful of milk or something, or lick honey or ghee to sustain them. But the cases of people remaining in Samadhis for a year or two, these are not the Samadhis the Samadhis we're speaking about here, because you are not permanently in that Samadhi. In order to remain in Samadhi permanently, in this case Nirvikalpa or Savikalpa, it has to have a duration. And transcendental state of consciousness is not based on duration. It's uninterrupted. It's a substratum on which all other relative states of consciousness take place, come and go, waking, dreaming, deep sleep. So this is how I understand that. And there is indeed, in tantric, yogic, and Vedic lexicon, language, there is the term Sahaja Samadhi. Sahaja Samadhi, it's called spontaneous, uninterrupted Samadhi. That is a very different state again. That is what it's called permanently abiding in state of unity. This is a spontaneous state. You don't have to meditate. It's always there. You are in that state.